Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc. All rights reserved.
Welcome back. It's 12 after the hour. Thank you very much for joining me. Thanks for hanging out with me. It's my pleasure. As always, I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate, and I'm glad you're here. I'm glad Steve Malanga is here too, ladies and gentlemen. He is here, by the way. Steve is a good friend of ours, a longtime member of our Brain Trust, contributing editor of City Journal, and a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He's the author of The New Left, which we have told you about and reported on this show in the past. He's also the co-author of The Immigration Solution, A Better Plan Than Today's, co-authored with Heather McDonald, Victor Davis Hansen, and those are the three, and Steve Malanga, of course. And he's our good friend. Steve Malanga, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, how are you?
We're doing good. It's good to have you back. Steve, I want to get into you had an outstanding column this week on who really pays taxes, on the truth about corporate taxes. But before we get into that, you're right there in the Big Apple. You're right there in New York City. You're in the middle of the whirlwind. Maybe on the outskirts of the whirlwind. I don't think you're downtown on Wall Street yet. But Steve, even as we speak, some of the chickens have come home to roost that people never thought would happen. Lehman Brothers took bankruptcy over the weekend. Merrill Lynch was sold to Bank of America. AIG, who knows what's going to happen to them? They're a New York Stock Exchange listed company. I mean, a big board company. I should say a Dow company, I guess it is. And there's a lot of carnage in the financial sector right now, isn't there?
There certainly is. Yeah. And essentially, this is not, you know, the interesting thing is that we've actually seen this in our lifetime, depending upon how old we are. I was a financial reporter during the 1980s, late 1980s and early 1990s, when people will remember that Drexel Burnham Lanham collapsed.
Right.
Also, before that, E.F. Hutton collapsed.
Right.
Kidder Peabody had to be sold to GE because it was in the process of collapsing. And the reason those
right.
firms collapsed back then is because essentially Wall Street lost its profit model in the 1980s. It was really feeding off of junk bonds,
mm-hmm.
and the junk bonds.
The junk bonds of the early 80s, which
right,
yeah,
which created this whole atmosphere where companies and raiders could go in and buy companies, and that stoked the stock market. And when that collapsed, after we found out that there had been insider trading, and after some of these guys
yep.
were indicted,
and went to jail.
Exactly, and went to jail, and then a lot of the businesses that had used junk bonds to finance themselves collapsed. Essentially, we found out that Wall Street had a lot of their profits sort of evaporated quickly. That a lot of the firms that had been expanding were expanding using a profit model that wasn't
mm-hmm.
sustainable.
Right,
and there's something similar right now, because what happened is after the tech bubble burst in 2000. A lot of these
we should point out, was another example it's just a variation on the same
yeah,
theme
variation,
of what happened
exactly.
in the late 90s. And you know, people talk about all the jobs we had in the late 90s. A lot of those people should never have been hired.
Well, certainly on Wall Street, that was the case.
It was the case in the technology industry.
And certainly in the tech industry, and we saw
yeah.
that. But what happened was Wall Street was very good about finding a new profit model very quickly after the tech bubble burst. And that new profit model was to use these collateralized debt obligations
right.
and to move to see that people were very interested. Home ownership was something that, you know, the American dream. There was they created a financial instrument to help
right.
exploit that. And that, up to a point, that made a lot of sense. But then that actually sort of, you know, we sort of wound up in the same situation really with junk bonds. A lot of these collateralized debt obligations, which were bonds, were not
mm-hmm.
sustainable also. And so, you know, what you have is you have these cycles where Wall Street finds something that it latches onto that becomes unsustainable, And when that happens, you get this, you know, you get this tremendous shrinkage and turmoil in the markets. And you could make an argument that Wall Street is much larger than it needs to be, that, that our financial system, that our basic financial system isn't as large as it should be. And we're seeing, you know, another big downsizing in the system. And it creates a lot of pain because it doesn't happen smoothly. It happens.
Well,
you know,
but it's happening. You know, the difference is this here, though, is that this seems to be systemic. This is not one shop, one company, you know, one type of a transaction. This is, seems to be systemic, Steve. I mean, look at how it's rippling through everything. I mean, this is not a lot of this is not just national. There's a lot of global implications here too.
Well,
Steve,
I would argue though that what happened in the 80s was systemic too, because you'll remember that the same time it happened, we had the SNL crisis. You remember that we lost several thousand small SNL banks that the
government was mostly driven by commercial real estate and tax. That was, you know, because of the tax advantaged transactions that was happening, and there was a lot, but you know, Merrill Lynch wasn't in jeopardy. I mean, our basic, other than the SNLs, I mean, I just, that was a $300 billion deal. That looks like a toothache compared to what we got right now.
Well, except that the SNLs were happening at the same time that Drexel Burnham was going out of business. It was the fourth largest.
Okay,
I mean,
are you trying?
I remember vividly because I was covering this. I mean, I remember sitting in a hotel ballroom as the Resolution Trust Company auctioned off homes that had been seized from banks. So you had all around, you know, certainly in where I live and all around the country, you have places where there were, again, foreclosures. And so this,
I remember that, and it was rough on Wall Street. I remember that. There were a lot
and
of jobs
rough,
lost.
Rough, it was
the
rough
real estate,
the whole country.
The real estate market crashed there in the New York area?
Right. Well, but not only in New York. You remember that essentially the recession of the early 1990s, the national recession, which cost the first George W. Bush, H.W. Bush's job, that was essentially not a manufacturing-driven recession. That was a financial-driven recession also. So, you know, that was
are you really trying to make the case that what we got right now is not as big bad a deal as not as big a deal as we've had in the last 20 years or so?
I think it's on par with that, and I think it's likely that we'll have a national recession as a result of that. So I think
Hold on to that thought, Steve. We're going to come right back, folks, with our good friend Steve Malanga. He's going to be with us for a little while. We've got more to come after these messages. 20 after the hour. I'm Jim Blassingame. Stay with me. Back, it's 23 after the hour. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate. My websites are smallbusinessadvocate.com and askjim.biz. Hope you check those out and use them to your advantage. We built them for you. Steve Malanga is our guest and our good friend, longtime member of our Brain Trust, contributing editor at City Journal, also a senior fellow at Manhattan Institute. And Steve, why don't you give us your websites, please?
City-journal.org.
Okay.
And then there's also, of course, realclearmarkets.com, where I write a lot of stuff. And I think in these next couple of days, reading what's going on, what's on Real Clear Markets, will probably give you a real clear idea of what's going
on. That's a good place to go, folks, to find some level-headed thinking about what's going on. Steve, one of the books in my studio, I have some bookcases, bookshelves, and where I keep different things that I want to refer to quickly. And the one that I always look straight at is a book that was written in 1848 by Charles McKay, Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. Now, that's the title. Extraordinary, isn't that a great title?
Right.
Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. Now, this book chronicles the tulipomania of the 1600s, I forgot what exactly. It chronicled the Mississippi scheme of the early 1800s and the South Sea bubble of about the same time. Now, if you replace some of the circumstances, I mean, some of the locations and the people, you could overlay, you know, any of these stories could sound like these examples that you were talking about, with the SNL meltdown, the technology bubble of the 90s, the, you know, on and on, the junk bond era of the early 1980s, and then of course the subprime meltdown, the financial crisis that we've got right now. So basically, Steve, if you understand what you've been saying and you read McKay's book, you realize that humans don't learn anything. We can't learn anything from our mistakes.
We move on. In each of those situations, here's the crucial thing that you have to understand. You can talk about Wall Street, and you know, Wall Street is the, you know, selling these different kinds of instruments. In all of those circumstances, there's one thing that's common. There has to be buyers.
Somebody has to buy this stuff.
There has to be buyers. And, you know, if you look at the tech boom of the 1990s, there were a lot of ordinary people who were turning into... I remember having a conversation with a woman, you know, in my condo association. She was a school teacher, and she was buying left and right. She had just gotten heavily into the marketplace, and I remember having a conversation about the Netscape IPO, and you remember that was one that zoomed out of control. What happened is that she had now put a limit price.
Oh, no.
And she bid like $20. She thought she was going to buy it at $20. She wound up buying these shares at like $70 on the first day. She didn't understand. People were doing that. Same thing with these collateralized debt obligations. You had buyers around the world who were buying these things. They didn't know what they were. They weren't looking into those. So if there's a common thread for everything from the tulip mania to today, it's that ordinary buyers hear about these things. I don't know where they hear about them on financial advice shows. They jump into them and they don't understand them. You know, and I have to say, I as much as I know about the marketplace, I'm a pretty plain vanilla investor. Meaning, I invest in good companies.
You're not a trader. You're an investor, though.
I'm an investor,
and that's a very important point.
Yeah.
Steve,
let
me ask you: do you think that what we're going through now, though, do you think it's, I mean, the magnitude of the size of these companies, the sheer number of failures and restructuring and collapses, don't you think this is a little bit more serious than some of the stuff we've gone through over the last few years?
Well, here's the thing that I will say. What distinguishes the last few years from today is this. Every time we've gone through something earth-shattering on Wall Street, Wall Street in the last 40 years has been able to rebound by finding something else.
Mm-hmm.
After the junk bond market fell apart.
They moved on to another fruit of the month.
They moved on, and they've moved on successfully. People seem to assume that that's going to be the case over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, Wall Street's profit model has been destroyed. If they don't find something else, this could be like what happened on Wall Street in the 70s, where essentially we went into an investment dive that lasted for 10 years. Over the course of those 10 years, the marketplace actually, on an inflation-adjusted basis, declined by 40%. And so that's really the crucial question. Wall Street's been very good about reinventing itself. I'm not quite sure that people trust them enough so that they'll be able to reinvent themselves and find a lot of new customers.
And regardless, though, what is that new product? What is that new thing to get excited about? Where is that going to come from?
It's an interesting question. No one would have anticipated after junk bonds sort of fell apart that we would have a tech boom. No one would have anticipated after the tech boom fell apart that we would have these mortgage-backed obligations based on... So you don't know where it's coming from. And I've talked to people on Wall Street who even today are confident that there's something else around the corner. I'm not quite so confident. But this is what Wall Street has done in the last 30 years. And people don't quite understand it. They keep reinventing themselves. And at every point, if they hadn't been able to reinvent themselves, the downturn would have been much longer.
You know what the next one's going to be, Steve, if there is one?
Yeah, I'm listening.
Energy.
And you know what? That could be a bubble too.
I know. I didn't say it was going to be the right thing. I just said it's going to be the next thing.
That could be a bubble.
Hold on to that thought. We come back. Steve's going to help us understand about corporate taxes. Who's paying the taxes? Do corporations pay their fair share? He's been writing about this recently. It ties in perfectly with what we've been talking about. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
And now, back to the man who humbly and graciously accepted the 2002 Small Business Journalist of the Year Award.
Who's the man? Who's the man?
Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate.
Welcome back. It's 34 after the hour. Thanks for hanging out with me. My pleasure as always. Got Steve Malanga with us. Steve's still with us. And we're going to talk about, now that we've been talking about some of the challenges of Wall Street and some of the problems that have been created by and by some of the greed issues, some of the things that got out of hand on Wall Street. One of the big debates going on right now, Steve, as you know, in this political season, is whether corporations pay enough taxes or not. Now you've written a column recently that really spells that out. Net it out for us, please.
Well, let me try to do this quickly. It's a pretty complicated situation, but let's talk about both small businesses and big businesses.
Right.
This study, which was done by the Government Accountability Office, it was requested by several Democratic senators who kind of knew what it was going to say. It said that overall about two-thirds of small businesses don't pay any corporate taxes, and about a quarter of big businesses don't pay any corporate taxes. And this was played as being something, you know, this is terrible. You know, what's the matter with these firms? The study was very misleading for two reasons. First of all, most small businesses pay taxes, but they pay taxes on the income of their owners. And that's
there are only two tax-paying entities in the world, folks, in the United States,
yeah.
Individuals and C corporations.
Exactly.
Everything else is passed through to one of those two groups.
Right. So if you're a small business and you're making modest profits, you're not going
to... Even if you're making profits, though, you're probably an S-corp or an LLC or a partnership, which don't pay taxes. They only file returns.
Right. What you do is essentially you're paying the taxes as your personal income. It wouldn't make sense to do it any other way, because if you reported the income, you not only have to pay the corporate tax, but then when you take what's left and you give it to yourself, you have to pay the dividend tax. You're taxed twice. And sensible people, your accountant tells you don't do that.
Well, I'm going to get my return for my corporation today.
Uh-huh.
If I have a profit, if I have taxes to pay, that corporation won't pay taxes because it's an S corp. It'll flow through to my personal return, which will be done next month.
Exactly. And so it's misleading when you hear people say that small businesses don't pay corporate taxes, because they are paying taxes on that.
But the big companies are where most of the complaints are.
Yeah. Well, and then it says also a quarter of big companies didn't pay their taxes, and these are C corporations. But the problem is this. This was done for tax year 2005. And one of the things that I did is I wrote a column where I looked at the what's known as the Business Dynamic Survey, which shows what's going on below the surface of the economy all the time. And what this showed is in 2005, which was a very good year for the economy, we expanded by several million jobs. What was actually happening is that many companies weren't making a profit that year because they weren't doing so well. General Motors, for instance, lost $10 billion that year.
Mm-hmm.
And what the Business Dynamic Survey showed was that for every 7.6 jobs that were created by companies that were expanding, 7.3 jobs were being lost by companies that were contracting. And the 2 million jobs that we added was actually the difference between those. And the point that I tried to make there is that it's not surprising that in any year, even in a good year, a quarter of businesses would actually lose money, a quarter of big businesses. That actually, below the surface of our economy, there are always plenty of winners and losers, even in good times. People who don't follow our economy and who want to sort of demagogue, politicians who want to demagogue, can do that easily by implying that in a good year, isn't it horrible that a quarter of big companies didn't pay didn't pay taxes on their profits. It's not that surprising, because it's not surprising that a quarter of big companies in any big year don't have profits. General Motors was a perfect example. We don't tax people on their sales, their revenues. We tax them on their profits. And I have the statistic in my story. The Business Dynamics Survey is fascinating. It showed, for instance, in 2005, that every quarter, for every 500,000 new businesses that were being started, 370,000 businesses were going out of business.
Right.
And you got to understand that's the difference. That difference between 500,000 and 370,000 helps to create new jobs, but it doesn't mean that everybody's doing well all
that's
the
right.
time. And that's an important thing to remember.
And the
about
profit margins for most businesses is they're lucky if they have a 1% profit margin.
Well, certainly in industries like the supermarket industry and
yeah,
so forth,
they're not even right. going to make that much. Yeah, exactly.
And that goes to the other misconception, and that is some people say, and this was even said by some of the senators who was talking about this, you know, these companies that we're looking at, they had hundreds of billions of dollars in sales, and yet they paid no taxes.
Right.
They don't pay taxes on sales.
Right.
You know, Walmart has like a 3% profit margin.
Right.
So they're a $250 billion company, but they pay taxes on their profit, not their sales.
That's exactly right. Well said. And some reporters get that confused, too,
all the time,
unfortunately.
All the time.
Steve Malanga, thanks for being here. Good job today.
Take care.
Thanks a lot. Steve Malanga, ladies and gentlemen, with cityjournal.com. Quick break. Stay with me. I'll be right back.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.